don't make bad decisions. You look at how World War I started. Yes, it was a war between capitalist powers. It was an outcome, as Lenin said, of a global system that had morphed into monopoly capitalism or imperialism, et cetera, et cetera. But there were a lot of bad decisions that went along with that. If you analyze war simply as from a systemic point of view and ignore the element of human decision-making, you miss a big part of the picture. The U.S. didn't have to do all of the things that it did in the Middle East. So here we had the United States not using the peace dividend money to make the United States economy stronger domestically. There are 70,000 bridges that are in need of repair in the United States. That wasn't done. High-speed rail? No, that wasn't done. Creating lots of child care centers? No, that wasn't done. In fact, 70,000, one-third of all child care centers in the United States are about to be closed or are threatened with closure because COVID surplus relief funding is coming to an end in the next couple months. So the U.S. is endlessly at war because it decides we can now topple all of the anti-colonial regimes, many of which, like Iraq, wanted to be friends of the United States. Saddam Hussein would have been perfectly happy to remain as a junior partner of the United States. But the U.S. like, no, we're going to show the world who's boss. It's arrogance. It's hubris. It's this madness about power, unchecked power. The unipolar era allowed the United States policymakers to think that they were ruling the roost for the rest of humanity's existence. And China got stronger and Russia got stronger. So now, Anthony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, I characterized as just very, very pampered, privileged rich kids who have never needed or wanted anything. They get to make decisions now. They get to be these big geostrategic warriors infected with the same hubris and arrogance. They really are infected with hubris and arrogance. It's a driver. American exceptionalism, I mean, this exceptionally arrogant sort of set of policymakers leads them to keep making bad decisions. Did the U.S. win in Korea? No. Did it win in Vietnam? No. Did it win in Afghanistan? I mean, the U.S. could not defeat the Taliban. And now they're going to get ready to fight China? I mean, the Taliban offered in November 2001 to surrender. They communicated through a third party to Donald Rumsfeld and said, in exchange for amnesty, we will lay down our arms. We won't continue to fight against the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, to which Rumsfeld said, we don't negotiate with terrorists. Okay, well, 20 years later, the U.S. is driven from Afghanistan by the same forces that offered to surrender, a ragtag operation like the Taliban. Arrogance. Arrogance by individuals who have too much power and there's no accountability within the system. After 2001, the U.S. set up black sites, you know, for torture all over the world. The U.S. was torturing people and kidnapping people off the streets of Italy and France and taking them to black sites and torturing them. Did anybody go to prison for establishing a worldwide system of torture? No. The only person who went to prison was John Kiriakou. He went to prison because he got on ABC and said, the president's lying, there is a system of torture. So they sent him to prison. Not the torturers, the guy who said there was torture. So this is hubris and arrogance on display. The problem is they have so much power. The media has completely lined up behind this new Cold War. The American people, now if you take a poll, how do people feel about China? They don't like China. They hate China. They're afraid of China. That wasn't true in 2005. That's because the U.S. media has propagandized the American people with the war message of those who have decided that we must go to war with Russia and China. I'm going to end with this. I do want to talk about Ukraine because the American anti-war movement, I think, has been really unable to cope with the events of NATO and the Ukraine war, because normally the peace movement is always like focused on the fact that the United States has gone to one war after another war after another war. So it's kind of simple in a way, although I have to say when we were protesting in the streets against the bombing of Libya, not many people joined us. You know, we had been leading demonstrations of hundreds of thousands in Iraq. The bombing of Libya started on the same day, March 19th, as the U.S. invasion of Iraq, but in 2011. And we worked just as hard to build the demonstrations then as we did in 2003, but nobody came. Our demonstrations were 3,000 instead of 300,000. Because the demonization of Gaddafi was so complete, and Obama was the president, it wasn't Bush. So I think liberal people, progressive people thought, no, I'm going to sit this one out. So that was a problem. But it's not as big of a problem as Ukraine. Because in the Ukraine, Russia invaded. Russia violated the UN Charter. Russia violated Ukraine's sovereignty. And the United States, organizing NATO, said, we're coming to the rescue of Ukraine, and Ukraine is the victim. And it's obviously the victim because Russia did invade. So if you care about peace, the only thing you can do is demand that Russia get out of Ukraine, right? That's the basic mantra. That hasn't been the political position that we've been undertaking, though, because I want to explain why. It's not because we support the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but we're trying to make the argument, which we believe is real and conforms to reality, that the Russian invasion of Ukraine was actually part and parcel of a U.S. plan for war, major power conflict between the U.S. and Russia, or U.S. and China, but whereby they could find a proxy force, in this case, the Ukrainian people, to do the fighting, dying, bleeding, suffering. If Americans had been sent to Ukraine, the demonstration that we had on March 18th, which was several thousand people, would have been several hundred thousand people, because Americans aren't going to be saying yes to sending their sons and daughters to fight Russia in Ukraine or anywhere else. So if the U.S. is getting started on this path of major power conflict, which became official doctrine in 2018, you can get started if you have other people fighting and dying. Because if a Ukrainian dies, what happens? We think, damn those Russians. That's the basic line. If they were Americans dying, people would be saying, what are we doing in this war with Russia? But if it's Ukraine's dying, all we could, the American people don't just open up a space in your heart for tender feelings for Ukrainians. And that avoids the political blowback against a war that, for all intents and purposes, is led by the United States, financed by the United States, the arms are provided by the United States. It's the U.S. Pentagon that's directing the war. It's U.S. intelligence that's providing all of the coordinates about Russian targets. In all ways, the U.S. is conducting this war with Russia, but Americans are not dying. It's Ukrainians. There was an article, a report in the New York Times, a study, how many people have been killed or wounded in the Ukraine war. The report is ghastly. Maybe as many as 500,000 have died or been wounded in the war. Hundreds of thousands dead. I mean, that's the headline of the article. It's like, this is an immense level of human death and destruction and suffering. So about three or four paragraphs down in the article, there's also an assessment of the Ukrainian counteroffensive against Russia. And then the Times reporter, without shame, quotes a U.S. Pentagon official as saying, one of the big problems that we're worried about today is that Ukrainians are becoming casualty averse. So the article is about 500,000 people are dead or wounded. And then further down, you say the U.S. government is worried that the Ukrainians are getting sick of dying in record numbers. They're becoming averse to casualties. And then the Pentagon official says, they're blowing through precious supplies and equipment that we're providing in their attempt to break open the defensive fortifications of the Russian military, which include, like, the Russians have laid millions of mines. Instead of using infantry to go through the minefields, they're using precious equipment because the Ukrainians are casualty averse. The language of the New York Times is carefully crafted. They didn't say things like that are obvious. Ukrainians are sick and tired of losing their sons and daughters, but mainly their sons, in this meat grinder of a war over things like the Donbass and whether or not Ukraine should be a formal member of the NATO military alliance. They don't really want to sacrifice their children for that. They're becoming averse. So How can you really say you care about Ukrainians and then complain that they're getting tired of sending their sons to be killed in such record numbers? It shows they don't care about the Ukrainians. Their main concern is the Ukrainians are blowing through equipment, precious equipment, in order to save human lives. And that shows, in a way, in a very profound way, the real thinking about the proxy war. They need the proxies to keep fighting. They need them not to become casualty averse. And if you put the shoe on the other foot, when the United States, you know, so many Vietnam vets and Iraq war vets and Afghan war vets have PTSD. So many are suffering. The number of suicides by American service members is so high, in many cases higher than those who were died in the battlefield. And what causes PTSD? Well, war itself, of course, is traumatic. But what's also traumatic when it's a war against people, when it's a war against a population, when it's not simply a war against other soldiers. In Vietnam, the United States rules of engagement, for all intents and purposes, were to American soldiers, if you see a boy or a girl on a bicycle and they're 10 years old and they're riding towards you and you see that they have a backpack on, they could be part of the National Liberation Front. Shoot them. Just shoot them. Kill them. Because if they die, it's not a problem for American politicians. But if you die and your fellow soldiers keep dying in these large numbers, it's going to be a huge anti-war movement. There's going to be opposition. The rules of engagement in the United States were to minimize casualties in these different wars and make sure that you shoot first and ask questions later, or more likely, don't ask questions at all, because Vietnamese lives don't matter. Because American lives matter, not because the American bourgeoisie really cares about American soldiers. They don't want the political liability of the blowback of an anti-war movement, which is what happened in Vietnam. The reason there were so many mass demonstrations in Vietnam, when I was 12 years old, we were at war in Vietnam. When I was 13, we were at war in Vietnam. When I was 14, 15, 16. Same with all the young people of my generation. So at every kitchen table, you had to be discussing, well, you're going to be 18 soon. You're going to be drafted soon. You know, that war was part of the topic. It wasn't some faraway place. That's why they got rid of the draft and brought the volunteer army. They don't want those conversations taking place in American households. So the United States is very casualty averse for Americans dying, because it's a political problem for politicians if Americans die in large numbers. Shoot first, don't ask questions. Same with Iraq. They killed so many Iraqis. They just blew them away. You know, there was such a game to kill Iraqi civilians. Snipers would just for fun shoot women and children and civilian men and old people from long distances for fun. Because the thinking, the psychology of the war was, they don't matter. Those people's deaths don't matter. Your death matters because it will be a political liability. We think that the war in Ukraine was completely avoidable, completely 100% avoidable. It could have been easily solved by having a negotiated end to the conflict by the United States and NATO sitting down with Putin, sitting down with Russia, and saying, all right, we're going to agree that Ukraine will, as it has been for the last 30 years, remain a neutral country outside of NATO. We guarantee you that Ukraine won't be in NATO. But instead, the U.S. said, Russia can't tell us who our NATO allies are, and Russia can't tell Ukraine what military alliances it can join. Well, let's put the shoe on the other foot. Let's say Putin could have had an alliance with Canada and put nuclear and conventional missiles on the U.S.-Canadian border, or with Mexico at the U.S.-Mexican border. Missiles that have a flight time of 6 minutes, by the way, to their targets. Missiles that you can't defend against. And those missiles targeted Boulder and Denver and Washington, D.C. and Chicago and Los Angeles. Would the U.S. allow Russia to put missiles on the U.S.-Canadian border or the U.S.-Mexican border? Well, of course not. They wouldn't do that. And Russia was saying in November 2021, December, January, we're not going to let you do what you would never let us do. Put missiles that you can't defend against on your border. That's not going to happen. And the Russians amassed 150,000 troops in Belarus and in Russia on the eastern side of Ukraine. And Putin was saying, look, we have red lines. These are red lines. Do not cross them. Do not try to incorporate Ukraine into NATO. And to which Blinken said over and over again, those demands are non-starters. Why? Why are they non-starters? You don't have to be an apologist for Putin. You don't have to think the invasion of Ukraine was a good idea to have the understanding that this was an unnecessary conflict because the U.S. could have and decided not to come to the negotiating table. And during those 3 months, Blinken and Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, and then Biden later, after they told him what to say, said the Russians are going to invade. The media would say, do you think the Russians will invade? Yes, we think the Russians will invade. They asked them those questions over and over again. And each and every time, American officials predicted the invasion. I thought at the time it was not going to happen. Right? I thought, oh, this is just American propaganda saying Russia's going to invade. But they actually knew that Russia was going to invade. But instead of urgently going back to the negotiating table, they said this passively. Yeah, they're going to invade. Yeah, they're going to invade. Are their demands reasonable? No, they're non-starters. Why would they do that if you thought they were going to invade? Why wouldn't you rush back to the negotiating table if you care about Ukrainians? Right? If you actually care about Ukrainians, don't you then go back to the negotiating table to stop a Russian invasion by talking, negotiating, and trying to see if you can meet the Russians somewhere along that negotiating path? But they didn't do that. And the reason they didn't do it is they wanted Russia to invade. The U.S. wanted Russia to invade because the U.S. is very happy that they can have a war with Russia, the proxy war, the major power conflict, which is central to American military doctrine, where Americans don't have to fight and die and bleed and suffer, and meaning the American people, like most of our neighbors and friends, they might not like the war. They certainly don't want to send their kids to the war, but they don't care that much about the war. They don't care that much because it's not involving them. And that's the nature of what's happening. Now, where do we go? I believe the war will either come to a Korean War type armistice, whereby both sides agree neither side can win, but we're going to freeze the conflict. The Korean War armistice that was signed July 27, 1953, is still in existence. The U.S. won't replace it with a peace treaty. When Trump met with Kim Jong-un in Singapore in 2018 and Hanoi in 2019 and signaled that the U.S. might sign a peace deal with North Korea, that was then torpedoed by John Bolton and the super hawks inside the Trump administration. But the Democrats, too, are condemning Trump. I mean, you can condemn Trump for everything, but making peace in Korea should not be one of them. But that was torpedoed. It could be an armistice like the one that ended the Korean War. Or, and I think this is as or more likely, there will be an escalation. Because the Russians will not lose. The Russians have enough people, enough weapons, that they're not going to lose. And the U.S. has been insisting that Ukraine must fight, and not become casualty-averse, not worry too much about their sons getting killed. And that at a certain point, if there's a complete deadlock and nobody can really win, one side or the other will try to make a breakthrough. If Russia launches its own counteroffensive, I think the U.S. will then escalate the war. Because Biden can't allow Russia to look like it's winning. Then he'll look weak. None of the politicians want to look weak. So the logic is escalation. Russia is a nuclear power. It has 5,000 nuclear weapons. U.S. has the same number or about the same. China, which really was not happy about the Russian invasion into Ukraine. Ukraine was part of the Belt and Road Initiative. China wants good relations with Europe. China wants to sort of break Eurasia away from U.S. domination and integrate it into a Eurasian trade partnership. But they realized they had to stand with Russia because if the U.S. succeeds in overthrowing the government in Putin or weaken Russia dramatically, the Chinese are now thinking the war with us, the war with China, it will come that much quicker. So China looks at Taiwan right now as the trigger for a conflict in the Pacific. And the U.S. is building what's called First Island Nations, building military installations on all of the islands that surround China. And the U.S. is putting missiles there, and now the Marines are going to go to those islands, figuring if there's a war, a clash in the Pacific, China won't escalate the war and make it a thermonuclear war because the U.S. has nuclear primacy. The U.S. can win a nuclear war. That's the U.S. That's what Blinken and Sullivan are. They're playing nuclear chicken. Again, these rich kids who now have all of this power in a system that has no accountability and lots of hubris and arrogance as a driver. So that's where we are. Just to summarize, is it like the first Cold War? No. The first Cold War, you could kind of understand the world capitalist system felt threatened by the rise of revolution and the revolutions in Asia. But there is no revolution going on around the world. South Africa, Brazil, India, Russia, China, they don't want revolution. They want to be integrated and treated with some respect in the world economy. They're not trying to overthrow world capitalism. They're trying to integrate into it on a fairer playing field. The thing that's driving the U.S. position towards global conflict, major power conflict, is hubris, arrogance, a sense of insecurity that the United States is a declining power. The idea that if you put enough pressure on Russia and China, eventually their governments will collapse. The same logic that they've used for the blockade of Cuba, the blockade of Venezuela. Except now, instead of Venezuela, Cuba, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan being the targets, they're targeting the biggest countries in the world. And that's what makes the new Cold War more dangerous than the old Cold War. Because the old Cold War established an equilibrium between the socialist bloc, the Soviet Union got nuclear parity with the United States. They became equals, kind of, militarily. And that's when the U.S. started signing nuclear arms deals. The Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Range Treaty. All of these, this architecture of arms control stabilized the world situation because both sides recognized that they were in a situation called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. That in a nuclear war, in a war between the major powers, both sides will destroy themselves. And so that became a deterrent to war. But now the United States thinks it can win the war. It can win the war against China. It can win the war against Russia. That's why they've canceled all these arms treaties that were the hallmark of the Cold War arms control architecture. So we're in a situation that I consider to be more dangerous because the equilibrium that existed between the two camps, certainly by the 1970s, is gone. And the U.S., using exceptional arrogance and hubris, now thinks they can win the war. And this is our job. Our job is to try to reach the American people. Somebody said yesterday, well, how do you make the argument when Americans are not dying, when it's not really on people's agenda, when they're just being propagandized by every media, mainstream media outlet, how do you make the argument? And it's hard. I mean, let's face it, it's not that easy. If you have a situation where 70,000 child care centers are about to be shut down and 3.2 million kids are going to lose child care center, and we're going to send $200 billion of more advanced weapons to Ukraine, I think a lot of people, Democrats, Republicans, independents, will think, like, that's ridiculous. Why are we closing child care centers, one-third of which are likely to be closed, but we can prioritize missiles for Ukraine because the Donbass is so important to us? Because Crimea is so important to us? And once you start to think about it, that doesn't make any sense. So we have to at least go with these kind of arguments to the American people that in order to have social justice and economic justice and rational decision-making about how to distribute resources at home, we shouldn't be spending it endlessly for endless war. Thank you.
You were just listening to Brian Becker on Cold Wars, Old and New. He spoke in Boulder, Colorado in mid-September. Brian Becker is the National Director of ANSWER, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Michael Parenti, Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, and Vijay Prashad. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Brian Becker on Cold Wars, Old and New, and for Noam Chomsky's book, Consequences of Capitalism, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Hep Ingham, Terry McRae, Joshua Escobedo, and KGNU. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Remember this sound from your childhood? It's one of our most familiar wild sounds. The calls of Canada geese flying high overhead in long, gangly V formation. And it's one of our most enduring emblems of the change of seasons. October is the peak month in the southward migration of Canada geese. Geese that bred in summer in Canada and Alaska. But, you ask, aren't there Canada geese around all through the year, on park lawns and golf courses? Where do these geese fit into the picture? It's complicated. The birds we think of as Canada geese, brown geese with a white chin strap marking, actually comprise a whole range of geographic populations. Some are larger, some smaller, and most subgroups have distinct breeding ranges north of the U.S. border. However, some Canada geese are now largely non-migratory, much to the chagrin of golfers and others. Many of the geese that now stay year-round are the descendants of birds introduced by game management authorities in an effort to revive some of the original wild populations that had been decimated by the 1900s. So, while some Canada geese are migratory, flying thousands of miles each year between nesting and wintering sites, others are happy to stick around. We humans have made them an offer they can't refuse. Acres and acres of delectable grass on lawns, parks, and golf courses. There's a lot more to learn on our website, birdnote.org.
Witness the world's best cinema, meet the creators behind your favorite works, and encounter live shows that combine music and film at the Vancouver International Film Festival. Taking place from September 28th to October 8th, a stellar lineup of over 130 films from 70 countries will transport you to places you've never been. Embrace the magic of cinema with exceptional storytelling that leaves you captivated and inspired. Be in the room as VIFF Live shows breathe life into stories from the screen, combining live performance and cinema. And go behind the scenes with VIFF Talks, connecting you to the brilliant minds behind the work you love. Explore the program and get tickets now at VIFF.org. That's VIFF.org. Student discounts are available, and if you are between the ages of 19 and 25, you can also join VIFF's free U25 membership program.
Radio Goethe. Modern German music at its best. Every Wednesday afternoon at 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
This is Germany calling.
This is Radio Goethe.
You're listening to